Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Noise episode 277. I'm your host this week, Steve Raker, in between vacations and Comic-Cons to help bring you another episode jam-packed with Marvel Comics goodness, as you've come to expect from this year's podcast. Marvel Noise is a proud manifestation of the Deliberate Noise Network, benevolently overseen by Derek Coward. You can listen to his flagship show, Comic Book Noise, as well as a plethora of other podcasts on the Deliberate Noise Network. Marvel Noise is usually hosted by David A. Price, and we welcome segment submissions, just keep the language family-friendly. Marvel Noise also has a Facebook page, a Twitter feed, but output has admittedly been light over the summer as I've been engaging in a Herculean amount of family fun and adventuring. And on that front, sorry for the extra skip week between this and last episode. We were kind of trying to sync up my availability between vacations and the Comic-Cons I've been going to. We'll get right to it here. This episode, we've got Kevin Whirlwind X, Andrew the L.A. Rabbit, and I presenting the penultimate, how's that for a comic book word, a penultimate installment of Busick Nicieza Thunderbolts comics, with the T-Bolts issues 104 to 107. But first, I tell those guys, who you can also hear with me over on our sister show, Indie Comic Book Noise, so I tell those guys, and you, about my trip to this year's Boston Comic Con and a whole bunch of the current slew of Star Wars books. So let's get to it.
Hey, summer readers. Steve Raker here from the Comic Book Bunker, along with Andrew the L.A. Rabbit out on the West Coast, and Kevin Whirlwind X up in the hinterlands of northern
the North Coast,
mid-northern Canada, catching the rainstorms and the lake winds.
We got to give some sort of name to his facility, the Beaver Dam or something, you know.
What?
We've got the bunker and the Warren, and now we need, you know, Kevin to have a base of operations.
The snow fort?
There you go.
Hey, it's just a few weeks until Baltimore Comic Con, which is at the Baltimore Convention Center, right in the Inner Harbor tourist trap zone of Baltimore, on Labor Day weekend, on September 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. And I'll be there with the No Apologies guys, and Alan, and Andrew?
Fingers crossed, there's been a personal illness in the rabbit household, so we're fingers crossed for optimistic. We have plans to go, but as you know, health concerns come first. But that's the current plan.
Ooh, that'd be so much fun. All right. I wanted to tell you that last weekend I came back from the Boston Comic Con. Went 2 days of the three. And I went on Friday, which was the, like, 10 to 7 type hour. Or no, it was like noon to 7. And then Saturday was 10 to 7 or 10 to 6, something along those lines. And on Friday, man, it was hot and humid, but it was the kids' family day. And by family day, and pardon me if I gripe a little bit, because Boston Comic Con is one of these things where it started out in a, you know, hotel basement and really grew grassroots-wise. And I think a lot of the online press and blogs and fan press and podcasts, ourselves included, contributed to building the show and building buzz about the show. And it became a real, you know, almost became like Baltimore Light, which is not a insult at all, because Baltimore is like Heroes Con Light, and Heroes seems to be the best show on the East Coast as far as comics art and really caring about the artists are concerned, and big name artists at that, and a little bit less of the Hollywood celebrity type stuff. So a couple of years ago, secure more Hollywood names, it seems, including Stan Lee last year and William Shatner and Frank Miller this year, they raised the prices quite a bit. They stopped giving out press credentials to any online, any fan press, any podcasts, blogs, websites, regardless of the traffic or the size of the audience was involved. So people were understandably upset about it. They also raised the age where kids could get in free. So instead of being like 10 and under getting in free, or 11 and under, or 12 and under, or whatever it was now like 6 or under. that kind of thing.
Look, Dad, I'm not a kid anymore.
Well, yeah, they're getting all those extra full-price tickets, right? So then last year, the first year of these new policies, it so happens that they had much less family stuff than the two previous years when they were charging when more kids were getting in free, so to speak, and it was more family-friendly in that sense. There were less displays to get your picture taken with, less props, that sort of business. Well, this year, they on their family day, which for the kids it meant they reverted to their pre-2015 policies for one day and let the kids 10 and under come in free. But Saturday, back to 6 and under only, and if you're 7 or 8, you're paying full price. But they did have more family stuff going on, but a lot of it was out, like, in the back hallway and in adjacent rooms off the con floor. Really unlike how Baltimore does it. And again, I think they were trying to style it after how Baltimore does their family programming, which is cool. They have a big roped-off area right in the con floor, surrounded by booths that are cleverly chosen as far as what artists are around so that you get people who do more family-friendly and kid-friendly and all-ages type books in the booths surrounding that area. And there's a whole bunch of tables where families can just come and sit down at any time, and they have somebody there doing stuff, you know, a draw-along thing or a make-your-own superhero masks or whatever the thing is. But they got stuff going on all day. But here, you're off the con floor and in a separate room with nice air conditioning, which is good. But everything seemed like it was over capacity, like you couldn't get in on any of the classes or things, and the line seemed real long for stuff. They would have, like, face painting, balloon animals, meet some of the cosplayers kind of thing, and, like, some coloring on the tables, stuff like that. But to have it all be separate, you would have to not really feel like you're part of the con floor experience if you wanted to, like, be with your kid doing some of that stuff, where you get a much different vibe in if it's all included, like I'm used to seeing in Baltimore. They also had vehicles, like celebrity vehicle things that were cool. They had the Batmobile 66, they had the Flintstones vehicle, they had the Scooby van, Mystery Machine, the Ghostbusters vehicle, but they were up two flights of stairs or escalators and out the front door outside, then back the whole length of the con. Like, if you went into the con just to see that, you would have to walk into the con, walk all the way to the back, through the back doors, up two flights, and then walk the same distance you just walked, but outside, all the way forwards, to get to where these things are.
What you need is a car.
It's twice the length of the con, basically, to get there.
You need a vehicle to get you to the vehicles, is what you need, Steve.
There was also no food on the con floor. Also, that was out the back hall and up two flights of escalators, but inside. So the lines were up and separate, and you couldn't stand online and, you know, watch the cosplayers walk by or that kind of business. And cosplayers, even, they were really touting more cosplay this year than ever. But again, they had a lot of that going on in separate areas and off the con floor, which might be a relief to some people who, you know, don't want to get bumped with Hawkman's wings, you know, when they're walking up and down the aisles. But I think the freak show is, you know, feeling like you're in a big giant clown car is part of the fun of walking around the con floor. And it almost seemed like there was less than ever instead of more.
It felt like at San Diego. I could have swore the same thing. Like, there was a lot of cosplay, but I'm like, it felt like, I don't know if it was the weather, maybe, because it was hot this year for San Diego. So maybe that's, you said it was hot, so maybe that just drove them out.
My kiddo and I went on Friday, along with one of his friends, and my kid's almost 12 years old, so hardy enough to walk around, you know, all day long with me. And then later on, my 7-year-old and my wife came in the afternoon when it was easier access to just get in. You know, it's crowded walking around. It seems like the con has almost outgrown that space, even on a Friday afternoon. Wasn't quite facilitating being able to really stop and look at artists' booths. But if you knew what you wanted to do, and you knew where people were, and you knew what you wanted to get done, there was a real nice guest list and a real nice artist alley of people to, you know, approach and to try to do business with and to see and to thank and to chat with and all that good stuff. Also, being in Boston, out on the pier, no-name seafood restaurant, some nice Mexican restaurants around, it's a good zone. our friends from the 11 o'clock comic forum days, who are now I see more on Facebook than anywhere else, but I see every year when I go to Boston is Monsta, John Cardinal, and his buddy Mike Sherpa. They were the only artists in the retail zone, which made them a fun little oasis to stop at and talk to, you know, every few laps around the con floor.
Did they like being that? I'm always curious, because you do. There's always like a few. Normally they keep everything in the same sections, but you do find like, hey, what's an? I remember one year Mike Grell was in like the celebrity autograph alley stuff, and it was. I'm always like, I wonder how if this is better or worse.
Yeah, it was a gamble on their part. I don't know how they felt about it. I think it ended up being a pretty neutral swing, you know. But you got to make table and pay for all the art that you end up buying while you're there too. And John really likes Predator, and he got both Eric Larson and Jay Lee to do Predator.
Oh, those couldn't have been cheap.
A lot of the artists were complaining actually that the weekend, at least Friday, wasn't that good and overall, and some were saying sales were down more than half from last year, which was interesting.
Oh.
Again, maybe the heat. But I talked to Fred Hembeck. He said he was doing great. So, but he hasn't gone to the last few Boston Comic Con, so I guess he was more of a hot ticket. The con layout had like a retail zone, a like celebrity side zone where they had like Shatner and Gillian Anderson and, you know, people from Doctor Who and stuff. And then they had the special guests, artist guests, Capullo and Jay Lee and Larson and Sam Keith and John Cassaday. They unfortunately didn't put some folks like the Allreds and the Palmiotis, and even Terry Dodson could have been in that zone too, because their lines ended up taking up lots of space and having to be broken up across aisles and stuff. Here was the weird thing too, because of this whole eating upstairs, out the back doors, up two flights thing, there was nowhere to sit on the con floor, including the con floor. They'd come by and be like, get up off the floor. Like if you were going and sitting over by the wall and trying to find a spot and sitting down like around a column or something like that. And not only that, no leaning on the wall.
And on
Saturday,
ridiculous.
They had signs up on the wall after shushing people off the wall on Friday. And they're like, this place is to sit upstairs. And it's like, well, then you got to go up two flights. And that wasn't well managed. The panels were also upstairs. Which is fine because they were better air conditioned. I went to a Capullo Snyder panel where they were talking about their next projects and stuff. And Capullo being a friend, that is the easiest place for me to catch him and talk to him for a few minutes because I'm not waiting in his line.
The last time I saw him in a show, it was well regarded but ridiculous. Yeah, it seems like it's feast or famine. You either got people like, and I like Jimmy and Amanda a lot, but it's either like they have a million people in line, or then you'll see some well-regarded person and you feel like you can just go right up to them, but you either got a million people or nobody, it feels like.
On Friday, like some of the good artists I touched base with was Art Adams, whose commission list was filled up before the con even opened up. It's incredible. But I bought a print from him and some sketchbooks and stuff. I love to get the little con sketchbooks from people so I can see a whole bunch of their commissions. Raphael Albuquerque, was able to get him to sign my Absolute Court of Owls of Batman, because he did one of the stories in there. And then I caught Snyder and Capullo up after that panel and were able to get them to add to it. The Allreds, I had never met Mike and Laura Allred, so that was really cool. Terry Dodson, I hadn't met before and was able to purchase some more of his more like European type stuff that's published from Humanoids that I dig. Aaron Lopresti, who was like a table mate with Terry Dodson, they were right next to each other on an end cap. He drew a She-Hulk on my Friends of the Fantastic Four jam piece that turned out really nice. Then on Saturday, I was able to get Ken Lashley to do a Black Bolt. And he hinted that when he chose to do Black Bolt on that piece, that he would be someone that I would be associating with the character in the very near future.
Nice! I picked up a page of his old pencils in an auction for like a couple of bucks from an old series. Glad to see he's still making the rounds, and that would be a pretty big get for him.
Smiling the whole time, and I was thinking of having him draw one of like Crystal or... Medusa or something along those lines. They're on the piece too, because he always draws nice ladies, but he was like, I want to draw Black Bolt. I'm drawing Black Bolt right now at home, that kind of thing.
Doesn't need the reference.
Eric Larson was really approachable, and I was able to get him to sign a piece to me that I had bought off eBay a while ago, which was nice to have that personalized, and also draw Surtur, the fire demon, on my Thor jam, which was great. On Saturday morning, I was able to get Pat Broderick from the old Micronauts days and Captain Marvel, and gosh, he probably drew a little of everything throughout the House of Ideas back in the 80s. He drew Loki on my Thor piece. So it had some good scores on original art.
Very nice stuff, Steve.
The highlight, though, of the weekend, I mean, I touched base with people who I had not met before, like Mark Schultz, you know, from Xenozoic Tales and all that stuff, and touched base with folks who I meet up with whenever I can when they're at a con, like Eric Talbot, Dan Parent from Archie fame, Billy Tucci, Howard Chaykin, you know, Jeff Darrow, people like that. Met Jeff John Cassidy for the first time, and he signed some of my book plates, you know, that I like to stick in my hardcovers rather than carry around hardcovers. I'll print out a book plate with the logo of the con on it, so it has like the date and stuff, and he was really taken by it. He's like, that's a really good idea. And as he's signing them, he says, boy, you know, and it's got the con label there and then the date and everything, that's really cool. He's like, you should market these, you know. So he was really kind and fun to talk to. I caught him right before he was going to show up and was able to stand in like a 10-minute line for him when a couple of years ago in Baltimore I couldn't even get near him. Touched base with Mark Wade, Terry Moore, Jenny Frizen, Fred Hembeck, Nick Jagoda, Marv Wolfman. But the highlight of the whole weekend was seeing Bernie Wrightson. That guy,
yay,
he takes up two spots on my Illustrator Mount Rushmore, honestly. I bought a big, nice, oversized, like 13x18 Gleasy print, however you pronounce those real high-quality prints on that well-toothed paper.
I don't know. That is a good... I wonder how you... I always thought it was like Gleasy,
whatever. But the one of the guy with the axes, with the axe, and he's leaning over the fence with all the heads all on the fence. Oh, man. It was the only one he had, and I just had to have it. And got a picture with him and got a hug from him, and it was great to see Bernie Wrightson. Love that guy. Anyway, the odd thing about the con after... I mean, it was good for a day and a half. It couldn't be a three-day con. I got almost everything I needed to get done on Friday, even with my kiddo in tow. And just Saturday morning, just did a couple of things. And really, by lunchtime Saturday, was done and out of there and joining my family, popping around Boston. They continue to make, you know, some logistical errors. Like I said, it's kind of about how the layout is and stuff, and maybe it's that they're outgrowing the space. But even just how they line up the traffic outside, everyone's lined up in the sun to go into the con, and it's in the morning time, and you're out on a pier, and there's an east side and a west side. If they just had the line go counterclockwise, the people who are standing there the longest would be in the shade, and the people who are there the shortest would be the ones who are in the sun in the back of the line, you know, that kind of stuff. And having more accessible family photo ops, it seems like those are the things that people like to have the opportunity when they're walking around with their kids. I think a lot of people were shell-shocked at the crowds and just trying to make their way through, you know, like cattle with their family on family day on Friday. But
all this stuff has just gotten more pop. You know, I don't think there's any of these shows that are less popular.
So here's the thing, Kevin. On Sunday, all the buzz was, and I wasn't there on Sunday, but I saw through Bleeding Cool, and then it was confirmed after that, Boston Comic Con was sold. Sold to the Fan Expo guys.
Oh, no. That's funny.
So, you know, the immediate rumor is that table prices are going to go up, that ticket prices are probably going to go up, and the fear is that there'll be even more Hollywood and less comic creator stuff.
It depends if it's called a Fan Expo show, I guess.
Well, that's the thing. Are they buying the name Boston Comic Con now that it's been built up to a kind of a big thing?
But it's probably for the name. I know they introduced some other Fan Expo shows in Canada, and it's like if you buy one of the higher level tickets, it's like you get free admission to like other Fan Expo events.
I was just going to say, they might want to keep the equity. I'm pretty sure didn't Reed buy Emerald City, and I think they're going to keep the name Emerald City. So yeah. I think sometimes you do keep it for whatever it's got, but I don't know how much cachet Boston Comic Con has.
Well, it's been built up into a bigger show, especially these last couple of years with their, again, having Stan and having Frank Miller. And I saw Frank on the street on maybe Friday night, it was, walking around. I wasn't going to bother the guy.
No, he does not look like he is, he looks like he's had some hard living.
He was fighting gravity. He looks like he's been out there and back, let's put it there. On a bright note, though, there were a lot of fun vendors. The kids were able to find their high-crafted foam swords and things like that from the cosplayer Renaissance Fair supplier-type guys and their LEGO minifigures. There were plenty of stands with tons of LEGO minifigures, both real LEGOs and the Chinese knockoffs and stuff for kids to pick from, and deals were certainly to be had. Also, both my kids and my wife picked out prints from a super nice lady at a stand that I wanted to give some attention to, and she's at www.melfinart, M-E-L-F-I-N art.com, and she has a real interesting style of having like a tight ink line of a drawing, even a schematic. She had schematics of like Legos and different devices, and one of my kids picked out an R2-D2 and another one a Stormtrooper helmet, and another, my wife picked out a Boston Skyline. But then she does like splatter colors all over them that are indicative, too, of the character that's being depicted. Very clever, very nice looking stuff, and she's got them in various sizes, and wanted to give her a shout out at Melfin Art.
Yeah, that's a mouthful. I'm glad you spelled it out. Nothing worse than when you're listening to a podcast and they mention like an artist really quickly, and then you're like, wait, what was that? And you're Googling kind of half the name. Because I did that the other day when I was like, wait, what was that? I'm trying to go back and listen and everything.
So Boston Comic Con, you've changed the last couple of years. I still want to go because it's close, and Boston is a second city to me after living out there for 10 years. So I have attended just on the Fridays, although this year I went Saturday morning too. I could feel a change in already. It was kind of like those last few years of the Grateful Dead, where it's like, this isn't, not sure if this is still my scene or not, but still some of my friends are here. But now things are going to change with next year, with the con being bought. So who knows? It could be a shot in the arm in the right direction, or things could play out to people's worst fears. We'll see. In the meantime, Baltimore Comic Con is still a fantastic show to go to, where it's just a big artist alley, and it's sort of Heroes Con light, and that is Labor Day weekend this year, and I am really looking forward to checking out the great guest list that they have, as well as touching base with a bunch of my buddies.
Yeah, I can't believe you stole all the comic guests in the entire industry.
Woohoo!
The Baltimore Comic Con is back. Labor Day weekend at the Convention Center. Meet Sean Astin, Samwise from Lord of the Rings, and Haley Atwell, Agent Carter from Captain America. Fun and cosplay all weekend. For tickets and more details, visit BaltimoreComicCon.com.
You like the Star Wars, Andrew?
I do indeed. I like it all. Movies, comics, artist editions.
It's still hard to believe that like Marvel's Star Wars again. And Star Wars is Marvel.
It's going to save Marvel like it did in the 70s, Steve.
I just spent the last 10 days or so in between doing camping vacations and going out to the Boston Comic Con reading 47 issues of the new Star Wars series, spread all what they've been publishing of late. And I gotta say, overall, I'm thrilled. Marvel's putting out some such Star Wars-y comic books. No offense, Andrew, to Jax and his intergalactic band of scoundrels and rascals and some other furry creatures. But offense taken, Steve. These are the best Star Wars comic books that I've ever read.
Not listening.
This current wave of Star Wars comics is fantastic and at a really high level of quality. Even the past few years, at the end of Dark Horse having the license to do the Star Wars books, they tried to up the ante and they did the Brian Wood stuff and they did some high-profile creators and tried to jack up some attention to the Star Wars books. This has been far, far more entertaining to me.
I'm loving it. I hold those Carmen Infantino, Howard Chaykin Star Wars comics in high regard. But yes, these I can unreservedly tell people what I've read of these things. I've really enjoyed it. Just snaps from one to the next. I mean, I think it helps being part of the Star Wars we're sort of familiar with. I don't know if this was set, you know, like 10,000 years before Star Wars or something, if it would have the same. I think that was the problem with some of that Dark Horse. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. The further from the material, the less you're like, wait, now I got to learn a bunch of new names and new whatevers.
Yeah, they've been careful and only peppering in new characters and managing to really tell stories with the core cast. I think it's been done very cleverly, and I think that's kept things being really interesting. They've kept a lot of side stories going on, so it's flashing in between the two different storylines, and then they'll merge at the end, that kind of stuff. Again, very Star Wars-y type storytelling.
Yes.
Simple storytelling. Well, straightforward.
You need to add new people, obviously, so that you can have the stakes raised. Because without new people, we don't know if they're gonna... You know, obviously we know that Luke Skywalker's not gonna get killed or whatever, so it's nice having those new people. Because then it's like, we don't know, maybe this guy got retired, or maybe he gets retired by Darth Vader putting the Force choke on him.
And speaking of new people, let's bring in the whole bunch gang on this. We've got Kevin, who can't stand Star Wars, and...
What's up, jerks?
And Phil!
No, Phil!
What podcast are we doing right now?
Welcome back to the
He's
Marvel.
He's teleporting in from the Starship Enterprise.
This is PG Phil, then.
So with Star Wars, they have the two main books are really the Star Wars itself and the Darth Vader book so far, all set in between episodes 4 and 5, right? Right before The Empire Strikes Back and after the first movie. And the regular series, we talked a little bit about them several episodes ago. The regular series and the Darth Vader book kind of coincided with this fun moment of Vader learning that the pilot that destroyed the Death Star's name was Luke Skywalker. And he had that whole big moment of like, what? And it also explains why he's so cold and calm and collected when the Emperor reveals this to him on screen in the movie. Because he's already dealt with this on his own in private in the comic books. And now with the two titles having merged for that moment, which they kind of got to from different sides of the story, then they break apart for an arc or so each and then come back together for Vader Down. Star Wars 8-12 was the 5-part Showdown on the Smuggler's Moon, written by Jason Aaron with art by Stuart Immonen and Jason von Grawbadger. Luke's in search of Jedi knowledge, right? He's without Ben. He's got to learn more here. He hasn't met Yoda yet. And he gets his lightsaber stolen on the Smuggler's Moon. And while he's in pursuit of the thief, he finds himself confronting Gracchus the Hutt, who also collects Jedi artifacts, and he puts Luke to the test in his, like, gladiator arena. Then Chewie and C-3PO are sent after Luke, but the bandaged bounty hunter Dengar is on their trail, and he messes up Chewie good, at least at first. Then Han and Leia escape some Imperials on a remote moon with the help of a woman named Sana Solo, who claims she's Han Solo's wife. And everyone converges to rescue Luke. There's this cool betrayal by the Hutt's games master character who was helping him manage the prisoners and stuff and ends up being an Imperial spy. a really good arc. I found it really Star Warsy with the different threads going, like I was saying before, and right up there with some of the best Star Wars comics I've read. Keeps the action going.
Yeah, and I thought on the ones I've read, the art has been evocative of the characters, but not too photo-y, so to speak. But like, it looks like them, but it's still a comic book. I'm not a huge fan when it's so...
Yeah.
When it looks like manipulated photos or something.
Sometimes LaRocca goes a little too far with some of the likenesses, but fortunately he's doing Darth Vader book, and it has a lot of original characters in it. So
Yeah. All the robots and everything that I like.
Darth Vader 7 to 12. Darth Vader's basically set up a covert operation without the Emperor knowing about it. He's gathered resources, and he's trying to seek out information regarding Luke. Could this be true? Could it be his son? So he's managed to secure the talents of this female archaeologist person, Dr. Aphra. And they stage a caper where they steal credits from a imperial rival of Darth Vader by, like, looting a ship and making it look like it was a robbery. And Darth Vader's written by Karen Gillan, I should say, with art by Sal LaRocca. Along with Aphra, Vader has these two droids that are these horrific...
They're the best.
They're dark reflections of R2 and C-3PO. It's BT dark. And 000.
They're a funny crew. They're a Laurel and Hardy type dark reflections team.
They're like war torture bots. It's hilarious. But the one has the same speech pattern as C-3PO. So when you're reading it like it's C-3PO talking, but he's saying such horrific stuff. And this whole arc in issue 7 to 12, it's called Shadows and Secrets, Vader's like straddling this line between hiding any evidence of his involvement in the whole caper of stealing the credits while acting as if he's trying to uncover who the culprits are behind the crime. And he's teamed up with this tenacious, monocled, you know, if you wear a monocle, you're definitely good at your job, Inspector Thanos. And the back and forth with the tiptoeing around the truth and stuff provides really great drama.
The story within the story of, you know, false flags and who's he gonna go. I also like sort of the fatalism of the young archaeologist who's like, knows, like, this is just gonna blow up. Like, she's sort of trapped in it, but she just knows that it's not gonna end well for her. Like, the odds of walking away from the Darth Vader partnership seem slim and none.
Especially a covert one where already he's like trying to clean up his tracks behind him. She's constantly waiting for him to be done with her, and he finds another job for her, and she's trying to figure out, is she, you know, become trustworthy enough that she's gonna be allowed to live? Is he showing some affection for her, or is he just has another job for her and then she's dead? She even puts it right out there a couple of times to him, like, I thought we were beyond this whole, like, you're about, you know, I'm going to die now when my job's done here stuff. It's interesting. And she and the droids have this sequence where they go to Naboo and they torture the mortician who did the burial for Padme, you know, for Princess Amidala, and was, before he died, although he was trying to be loyal to her, confirmed that yes, she had a boy. Doesn't give Leia up, but confirmed that she had a boy and that the boy was taken away, which then she could report back to Vader and confirm that, yep, it's possible, it happened. So now Vader also knows that the Emperor, you know, did this all behind his back and lied to him about Padme dying and all that stuff. So again, when the Emperor gives Vader this information on screen and Empire Strikes Back, and Vader's so cold to it, he's already contemplated it via these stories now that are canon. A couple of annuals occurred before the Vader Down story. The Star Wars annual number one was from Gillan and Angel Unzuda, and it's a one-shot story of this rebel spy named Ina Bray, who infiltrates the Empire on Coruscant, and then he gets activated to save some senators when they're held hostage in the Galactic Senate. Palpatine shows up, though, and the mission gets turned into a assassinate Palpatine while he's there, and the Senate gets leveled, all the senators die, Ina Bray fails horribly, and he has, like, a personal encounter with Palpatine that leaves him totally shaken. It's pretty heavy stuff. The Darth Vader annual is from Kieran Gillen and Lena Liu, where Vader travels to Shu Torin, which is a mining planet that has these needed resources for the Empire. And he travels there to deliver, like, this strong message to suggest that they cooperate with the Empire at all costs. Actually, the thing he's delivering is one little chunk of rock. That's all that's left of Alderaan, to say, hey, you do what we say. But he finds that the planet's in a civil war, like the ruling monarchy is having these uprisings from all these barons and stuff. And Darth Vader survives an assassination attempt and then dethrones the king and puts his daughter, who wasn't the next in line in succession to become the king, sets her up as like a puppet ruler. Then we jump back to the regular series for the Vader Down crossover. And that started with a Vader Down one-shot written by Aaron with art by Mike Diodato. And then throughout Darth Vader 13 through 15 and Star Wars 13 and 14, Vader gets shot down on Vargas Voss because he's chasing Luke. He finally knows where Luke is. And Luke is trying to find this Jedi temple that's there. There's also a rebel base there, and when Vader shows up, the rebels come and try to shoot him down, and Vader just takes out everybody, but Luke crashes, like rams him, like in a game of chicken, and they both go crashing down onto the planet on different spots on the planet, and the story goes from there. Luke finds the temple, but he gets attacked by Aphra and those sick droids. Han and Chewie get added to the mix, and there's this gray Wookiee bounty hunter. And Vader confronts Leia face-to-face in the field, which is kind of an interesting moment. It's the first time he's seen her in person since he had her in the Death Star prisons there. Also, Aphra at the end gets captured by our Scooby gang. And Vader finally wipes out his main adversary in the Empire, who is also searching for Luke, who is this Mon Calamari cybernetically enhanced creature. So Vader Down ended up being a pretty decent crossover. I mean, I got to read it in one whole chunk, so I wasn't waiting in between weeks or anything like that. But enjoy the serialized nature and the speed of being able to blow through these books. And that's a cool thing about these Star Wars books and Marvel. These are on the Marvel Unlimited now, so you can jump into that digital service and scarf up tons, you know, read these things an arc at a time, which is how I recommend it.
And the trades come out really quick.
Darth Vader 16 to 20 is still by Gillen and LaRocca. God, Sal LaRocca, you know, he's just steady. He'll just keep pumping out them books. Just like the Iron Man, he'll do dozens and dozens of books without a break.
He's pretty reliable.
This is the five-part Shu Torin War, Darth Vader issues 16 to 20. We got Darth Vader returning to that puppet empire that he established back in that annual. And he sets about the task of protecting the queen's rule by, like, getting the rebelling minor barons in line. With some harsh techniques, I gotta say. Also, the Emperor's chief enforcer, Silo, who is a cybernetics expert, and he's also the guy who helped build Darth Vader. He turns out to be a thorn in Vader's side, and he ends up having to be dealt with. In the end, Vader gets told by the Emperor that it's all been a plot to out the traitorous Silo. And Vader gets to confront that inspector guy with a monocle for the last time, because that dude, he's just getting too close. Also, what's been cool in the regular Star Wars series, in between arcs now and again, issues 7, 15, and 20, they've had one-shot interludes. The first one painted by Simone Bianchi, and the issues 15 and 20 by Mike Mayhew, and they've done excerpts from the Obi-Wan journals that Luke uncovered when he went back to Obi-Wan's hut on Tatooine. And they've turned into nice little interludes, and I think are going to end up making a nice collection in their own right when there's enough of them that build up. Star Wars issues 16 through 19 by Jason Aaron and Lena Liu is a four-part Rebel Jail, where Leia, Han, Luke, and Sana bring Aphra, who they've got captured, to Sunspot Prison, which is like, think of like the Star Corps satellite, but it being a penitentiary. It's like really close to the sun and hidden, and it's the super secret rebel prison where they take and are able to hold like Imperial spies and people they capture and stuff. But there's a break-in. and prisoners are being executed by the dozens. There's this terrorist in charge who keeps saying things like as if he knows Leia, and Leia's like, who is this guy? Ultimately, Leia and Sana have to enlist Dr. Aphra's help to make it out alive and take down the threat and save as many prisoners as they can along the way. And the bad guy turns out to be Enib Rey, the rebel spy who ended up having that direct encounter with Palpatine back in the Star Wars annual. So it's cool how those annuals ended up setting up future arcs when they go back to the material from them. Also, Leia turns an eye to letting Aphra escape, which lets her fall into place for Darth Vader issues 21 through 24. And issue 25 of that series is going to be the last issue of the series. So this is the finale of this whole Darth Vader run here, and it's entitled End of Games. And in this final arc, we've got Vader, at the request of the Emperor, chasing down that traitor Sylo, and he tells the droids to go find Dr. Aphra, which they do. And Vader finds Sylo, and he's got to fight his way through all these different obstacles to try to reach him, including like a cybernetically enhanced Rancor. And Vader reaches Sylo, who has a kill switch for all of Vader's cybernetics from when he helped build him, and Vader's just totally immobilized, and you kind of have to see, is Vader more machine or more man? Can he overcome without his respirator and stuff? And there ends up being one more twist to be played out in the last issue regarding Dr. Aphra, so we'll see how that series winds up, but I really enjoyed the Darth Vader series.
I like that. Was my favorite out of them all, for sure.
Doing all these side missions and stuff, and it's cool. And in character, it seems.
Yeah, I'm digging the Marvel Unlimited 2 to add to my pedantic title, though. I kind of wish that the annuals weren't their own little category thing in their indexing. Hmm. But that's a super minor point. Because I like to do that next to next to next thing. I don't know if that's how you read it, Steve.
Yeah. Also, the limited series, those are the regular series, the Star Wars and Darth Vader, but there's been an Obi-Wan and Anakin 5-issue limited series by Charles Soule and Marco Cicchetto, where Obi-Wan and his Padawan answer this distress call, and they go down to this planet, and the planet's at war with itself, the open versus the closed, and there's this old lady who's like a hermit who sent out the distress call, who is trying to send out like these little blasts of like propaganda information that have information about the culture that doesn't relate, that was like before they were warlike, to try to touch the youth because the adults are too embedded in this whole war thing. Ends up being good, and Anakin learns some good lessons along the way. There's been a 5-issue Chewbacca limited series by Jerry Dugan and Phil Noto, and this occurs during the Rebel Jail arc because Chewie isn't there. He's here. He's trying to return home to his home planet to deliver this gift to a descendant, and he gets sidetracked when his crappy ship that he's in crashes on this remote planetoid in the outer rim. On this planet, a gangster named Wom sets up this slave labor mine to yield this precious ore that the Empire can use for energy in a quick get-rich scheme that he has with the Empire coming, and he's getting things set up, and he's going to sell the whole operation to them. We meet this youth and her dad who owe the gangster money, and they're made slaves. And the dad, he risks everything for her to escape, and she does. But she comes back. And the dad's like, oh no, why'd you come back? She comes back for him, but this time she brings Chewbacca! That's right, she like ropes him into helping her. I mean, she and us readers can't understand a word Chewbacca says, but she gets him to help anyway. He helps to free her people and stick it to Juam, or Wom, whatever his name. And in the last act, there's this whole funny thing where they load up this droid like a Trojan horse with explosives, and they send it up with the gangster up to a Star Destroyer, an Imperial Star Destroyer, and hope that it's going to blow the whole thing up. The switch that they have for it gets wrecked, so they have to set a timer on it. And they just set a timer on it and let it go. And meanwhile, they're planet side, and they get captured. And don't you know where they get brought? They get brought up to the ship where they know that they've sent the explosives. So that ends up being a good, you know, final act for them to deal with that whole situation. Good Jerry Dugan stuff. He's got some funny lines in there and situations, and immediately end up liking the young female protagonist, who's like a Jubilee type, for lack of a better way to put her into a box.
Yeah, I think Wom is a space knight, Steve.
Might get to some of that over on Indie Comic Noise. Also, there was a 5-issue Lando series, also by Charles Soule, or Soule, with Alex Maleev art. And I talked about the beginning of it, and the end was really cool, too. Lando assembles this team of characters who end up being very interesting in their own right, especially how they all play out at the end of it. And they've got to make up and pay off a debt. They've got to steal a space yacht. Turns out it's owned by Palpatine, and he's got a whole bunch of treasure of like all these Sith relics that are being carried on it that he wants more than the ship. And when they go to and discover it, there's two Imperial elite guards there. They have to deal with that whole thing, and there's some betrayals from his bunch, but not from Lobot, because Lobot's like his right-hand man, and he and Lando are like blood brothers. But Lobot slowly, and especially after he's injured, so he's like losing some of his control, he's slowly losing himself to the cybernetic implants that he's got. And Lando throughout the story is like heartbroken as kind of he's losing his friend, almost like I wonder if Sewell's lost someone to like Alzheimer's or some other dementia, because some of those scenes were really touching. Really good. Enjoyed that series a lot. Lando. Billy D.
Lobot. I had that figure.
Me too. He was a common for sure. And then the last one I'll mention is there was a Star Wars C-3PO special, a one-shot, The Phantom Limb. And it's from the Starman team of James Robinson and Tony Harris. It takes a place before The Force Awakens, so it's like a prequel story. And in a nutshell, it's how C-3PO loses his arm and gets the red one. He gets marooned on a planet with a bunch of other droids, and he and this other droids are the last one, and the other droid's Silver, and he gets caught in this acid rain as he's like sacrificing himself to save 3PO, and 3PO ends up going and grabbing his arm and wearing it as a tribute and not rushing to have it painted anytime soon, again as a reminder of the buddy that he lost on this planet. Pretty good. I mean, Star Wars, guys, these are really good books. I've enjoyed every one of them. None of them has been a stinker. Even the Anakin Obi-Wan one.
Cool, calm, and unperturbed.
Yeah, that's the one that didn't look good to me, because it looked more like the cartoon, almost.
I started wanting to breeze through it, but then all of a sudden the situation stuck to me, and I was like, all right, now I kind of see what's going on, and I want to see what happens, and played out well. It's all been
done
well.
And it does connect with all the rest?
No, it's back in, you know, before the Clone Wars time, you know, when he was a Padawan and stuff. It's just another story to tell.
Welcome back, Marvel Noise fans. The Justice Like Lightning Thunderbolts crane will not be derailed. Operation Marvel's Most Wanted Justice Like Lightning is back. It's the usual gang, Steve, Kevin, and myself, covering our Thunderbolt segment. This is the segment where we started with the very first issue of Thunderbolts way back in the dawn of time. And since that time, we've covered crossovers, reboots, renumberings, and we're back onto the original numbering. You may have remembered we left off in our last episode at 103 on the cusp of Civil War. Not the Civil War going on now, but the Civil War, the original Civil War, the one that started it all, Stamford, Connecticut, the New Warriors. How will this impact our Thunderbolts? Well, one thing, it'll cut our covers in half, which I'm sure made the cover artist happy, because same pay, half the work. Although I wonder if they could sell those for the same prices in the original art market. You're only getting half the page.
Have you seen any of the original artwork for these covers? Like, I'm kind of curious.
I have not, but I gotta assume they're half pages, right?
I guess so. Like, you wouldn't draw, or you wouldn't leave a lot of, you know, like, it, some of them that had those big logos or something on it, like, there was, like, the House of M thing, like, the original cover just has huge areas of emptiness, and where the logo went, you know, it was, like, all the way down the side.
Yeah, I would think these would have, I mean, you'd have to tell, also because of the composition, you need to tell them so they're not putting essential elements there or anything like that. You know, you'd want the cover to still stand as half cover as it is, but let's go round robin quickly. I should formally introduce Kevin up in Canada. Say hi, Kevin.
Hello.
Super Steve in the bunker, making the trains run on time.
I can't believe that I can't believe we're this far. Like, we've been looked so far ahead to issue 100, and now it's this far in the rearview mirror already.
Yeah, well, once we started speeding up the train, Andrew started putting more coal in the engine there. You know,
we upgraded. Now. We're now Mach 5 on this. Andrew, the L.A. Rabbit, and as tradition here holds it, we usually have Kevin give us the rundown of our current Thunderbolts team.
Oh, and it's a biggie. It's a supersized lineup now. Just as a note, I know some people list, or some websites, just list the Thunderbolts team as like everyone that was a member during the Civil War time as a member of the Thunderbolts. Like, maybe I'm a Thunderbolt snob, but I don't consider any of those extra people like actually official Thunderbolts.
Agreed.
Like, that would be like
agreed
calling the Avengers Academy people or Avengers Initiative people like Avengers. Like I guess in the loose sense, like you could, but they didn't really.
Yeah. The Texas Twister was not only never a Thunderbolt, but he was never an Avenger either.
So with that preamble out of the way, our Thunderbolts lineup. Baron Zemo, a two alien Moonstones kind of guy. Songbird, Melissa, sound constructs kind of gal. Joystick, Janice, supercharged Styx. Atlas, Eric, big and gives everyone the boot. Radioactive Man, radiation. Swordsman, Andreas. He loves swords. Mac 4, Abe, flies and shoots. Blizzard, Donnie, or Donald, if you like, makes things into frozen treats. How about that?
I like that.
Fixer, Norbert, fixes and bets. Smuggler, Conrad, Dark Force Dimension Suit. He's also Eric's brother.
I do not consider him a Thunderbolt. Is that okay?
Yeah, he's only a Thunderbolt for several issues, I guess.
And Steve and I follow along on Marvel Unlimited, where you can join us too. And Kevin has the paper copies because this started with him being the original fan. I was new to Thunderbolts and Steve was somewhere in between. But now I feel like we've all have a certain level of authority. We can speak to these issues. And this is Nisienza with Grummet and Erskine. And thankfully, Marvel Unlimited has restored the credits page and the sort of summary and everything. So I'm glad that's back, at least on these issues. And Civil War sort of interrupted our storyline a little. There's this background brewing of Zemo versus the Grandmaster, Elder of the Universe.
But now we have Civil War. Better than House of M. Like, the Civil War is giving them an excuse to like retrieve villains and fight Captain America and do a few other things.
Yeah, I didn't realize how much of the whole villains being working for the government was established here in the title. Having just been reading the main Civil War title and some of the other titles that I was reading along at that time, I didn't jump out and buy every little crossover. So I didn't read these issues at the time. I didn't when it kind of hit me upside the head and less expected than it would have when all of a sudden the Green Goblin and those guys show up as, you know, government agents. Had I been reading it building here, the same thing with the 52 prison thing. All that was established here.
Yeah.
Very surprising. Oh,
I guess I should also mention we're not going to cover the Thunderbolts team that shows up in the Civil War proper, because that was a totally different lineup. It doesn't really play out anywhere else.
Yeah, so in our plot, Zemo is working for the government. He's on the pro-registration side, and they're collecting villains. And as they collect them, they give them the option of being shunted into this terrible prison that they're building with Pym and Reed Richards, or they can join the Thunderbolts and they form these different squads And those are the sort of errata thunderbolts that we're not considering. You know, Quicksand and Porcupine and all these interesting characters aren't really. But so the point is, as they capture these people, their army is growing. And so there's some tension about whether they'll remain loyal to the government, i.e. Dallas Reardon, Steve's favorite Thunderbolt, who Kevin omitted somehow, and Henry Peter, or will they stay bonded to this new Baron Zemo, who purportedly only cares about saving the world, although I'm skeptical. The one honorary Thunderbolt I will give is the traditional sucker-fingered beetle armor.
I like how Abe leads the group of beetle.
Squad.
Yeah, the guys in the beetle armors.
The Beatles.
Yeah, the Beatles. Abe and the Beatles.
The Fab Four, that's right. There's four of them. So it starts with the different squads are capturing villains, and it's a presentation by Reardon and Guy Rich to the whatever we're calling the Committee on Superhuman Activities. Commission, sorry.
Man.
It's called different. Yeah, and they also point out the, you know, can we trust Zemo with all this? But Zemo...
No. I mean, and what you're also seeing is the beginnings of the 50-state initiative.
Yes.
That would then follow Civil War also. It's amazing to see how much of that stuff is all being established here.
But another Thunderbolt that was a Thunderbolt, and I guess we're not considering... Radioactive Man? Are we considering him part of the team, Kevin?
He's been here for a long time.
He's the most level-headed one.
Yeah.
He's the new Songbird.
Seems like it, in a weird way.
He was lent to Pym and Richards to build this new prison. Zemo, through use of the two alien stones, has his floating base, which can teleport him wherever he needs to go. So that makes it conveniently. But he's helping out. And honestly, I would not have put him in the intellect grouping of Reed Richards and Hank Pym. I think I've underestimated his intelligence, I guess. I would put him as a strategist, but more like a Captain America type guy.
Yeah.
Same than here. A big brain.
Even making sticky paste blew up in his face, you know? I would put him one notch under. Yeah, I would put him one notch under Paste Pot Pete.
Yes.
Well, Pete paste stuff never Pete. Blew up in his face.
But he did dress like a painter.
French painter.
So Reed and Pym are, of course, sparring with Zemo. And Zemo's being on the up and up, he says. You know, he takes the jibes and he gives a few out, like throwing back to the plot line where Hank Pym helped blackmail the Thunderbolts into attacking the Avengers and those sort of jibes. But he's saying he's on the level and he ends up going back to his base. And basically, this is kind of the setup issue. Like they talk about, as I mentioned, when they defeat these supervillains, they join the squad. They go to the swordsman, who's not just Andreas, Kevin left off his last name, Strucker. He's a half of the Strucker twins. And the other half of the Strucker twin is part of his sword. And a sort of unnecessarily gruesome storyline that we'll coast over for now. But he's in the midst of training them, and he's training the Ox and Cobra.
You must enjoy that.
I did. I like Ox. Although I didn't realize, I thought he was just Cobra, not King Cobra. But live and learn. I always liked him in Hyde.
It's good to be the king.
Yeah, maybe he got a promotion when, Serpent Society went real big.
But, so while I'm making this sound kind of set-up-y, I thought the issue flowed really well, and it was good seeing some really nice Grummet and team do these wonderful shots because there's just a ton of characters.
Yeah,
like they have the four beetle ammo. They capture the metal men and the the UFOs. You know, like all these kind of knockoff type characters, Batroc the Leaper and everything. So there's these really wonderful things with just showing tons of these wacky characters.
How about Whiplash and Backlash?
But we finally get an A-lister, Doc Ock. Is trapped in this whole scheme and sort of has a little bit of playing with Zemo. But the big twist is, and where it ends, is that Zemo goes to the anti-registration side and says, hey, I got the keys that's going to help you escape your buddies out of jail. And I'm like, nice, Zemo's playing both sides again. I think Steve might have been correct. Maybe we shouldn't trust this guy. And I really liked on the Unlimited, they also threw in one of the, what used to be Stan's Soapbox, but is now Marvel Heroes Hotspot.
Oh, wow. You guys have that?
Yeah, I was really surprised that they, I mean, I'm happy that they threw it in, but it shocked me a little bit to have that in the digital issue.
So you have the five fun factoids from Andy Schmidt?
Yep. And Aubrey's out of context funnies.
Yeah, perhaps not that funny.
Yeah. But of course, they were going to go there.
But I'm glad they didn't take like one of the super racist old timey panels where not all the characters were portrayed with a lot of grace and style in the 40s. Let's leave it at that. But that was it. Like I said, while sort of a setup, I thought I was pretty happy. Like it felt like there's a lot happening. Like this is really building to something and is, you said, Kevin, I feel like they're folding Civil War in way better than that weird Captain Marvel, sorry, Janice Vell, sorry, Photon, sorry, whatever we're calling them today. Bizarre well, House of M issue.
Yeah, because I can't imagine what the story would have been like without Civil War. This is the ideal thing where you're like, oh, you merge your story in with whatever's going on with the universe. And then you get those horrible ones where you're just, like, sidelined and you could have just skipped the book. Like, this is so enmeshed. Like, if you would say, oh, I don't want to participate in this event, and then you came back with, like, 106, you would have missed some important stuff.
For sure, for sure. Steve, did you like this 104 as far as the flow and the build-up and everything?
Yeah, I think, like you said, the Tom Grummett art really helps. Keeps everything clean, and he's a great storyteller.
Yeah, Grummett and Erskine are really... I always like having him, because that was the... wasn't that the professor that helped Captain America get his super soldier serum? So
and even the talkie scenes are handled with nice dynamic angles and stuff, because these guys are pros.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really appreciate the art on this run.
Great having...
My next two Thunderbolts are bent somehow. You know when you have too many issues standing in a stack, and you sort of get that bent edge... towards the spine. Like, I don't know why the next two are bent.
Yeah, you need dividers.
Yeah, it's just weird. Because my other Thunderbolts aren't like that.
Too many books in the box. They're pressing. They slid to the side when you overstuffed it.
Oh, my God. All my comics from my youth, the ones I kept, they're so beat up. I'd leave them sitting in these huge piles, and they get that bend in the middle. Because, you know, I just read them and would leave them here or there. I didn't bag and board. Sometimes I bagged and board, but not nearly as convincingly as I should have. But digitally, these things are crisp and clean, and we cut right to the next issue, which has Zemo facing off against
Captain
the heroes.
Captain America again?
Captain America, Falcon, Hercules, Daredevil. A really great opening cover of the heroes coming at him and him reaching for his sword.
Don't worry, Red Wing's got this.
Yeah, you're right. What I like about this, too, is it like references all that history. Like, if you know Zemo is going up against Hercules, they're like, oh, that's not going to be good. But it's never really good with the Thunderbolts and Hercules.
No, they have... Zemo keeps protesting he doesn't really want to fight and uses more defensive-style powers. But as Steve intimated, Red Wing grabs the Moonstones. And they launch a second attack that disarms the sword. But Zemo points out that he doesn't have to be touching the Moonstones to control them. And zaps Red Wing. We're like, what? And then on the page turn, he zaps him right back to Falcon. And he's like, yeah, I'm not going to kill him. I'm giving him a fate worse than that. I sent him to Bayonne, New Jersey.
Yeah.
And I'm like, when did... Like, I'm glad he turned around, but like... New Jersey jokes and Animal House references and stuff. I'm just not sure that's really Zemo's stock and trade ordinarily. Eventually, he has to restrain Cap with the Moonstones to get him to talk.
But like usual, Cap's like totally against him, saying, oh, of course, you had to mention all these things you could do to us. Like, Cap's never a fan of Zemo.
Well, to be fair... The whole Bucky thing didn't really work out great with the Zemo family and everything. And remember, this is prior to, I believe Bucky hasn't been resurrected as the Winter Soldier at this point. So Bucky's dead, or as dead as you can get in the Marvel Universe, anyways. Yeah. We wouldn't know that he really wasn't dead. So, and Zemo reveals that he burned his face to save Captain America, and it wasn't just an Adhesive X blow up this time. Smash cut to Melissa ordering a rock and a shot, although I don't see her get the rock.
Yeah, she should have ordered the Songbird cocktail. That's what she should have done.
Should Dallas be drinking and driving?
Why?
She's in a wheelchair.
Can't she just drink as much as she wants?
She's got the government to wheel her around. But this is a Thunderbolt staple of, like, the... We get a cutaway to something going on. And it turns out that Melissa's been working with Dallas Reardon. Because the whole time we've been having this... Melissa's claiming that she's going to kill Zemo. But she's also romancing him. And we're not sure that Melissa's that good an actress. So, like, I think she's going to go after him. But I'm not sure. And, you know, you'd think Zemo would clue into that. But from there, we cut all the way over to one of the other main squads. And they're doing another recruitment against a figure I was unfamiliar with. I think there's a lot of 90s references here.
Oh, not right here, I don't think, no. There's going to be some coming, though. But it looks like they're recruiting Iron Maiden and maybe they'll get around to Judas Priest as well.
Yeah, I don't remember Iron Maiden. I just assumed it was a 90s villain.
I think
so. That's why.
Weren't they before 90s?
She was in that Marvel fanfare that George Perez started the Black Widow story with and then had to leave it. And they had Marshall Rogers and I forget who else they had help finish it. But yeah, back from a Black Widow Marvel fanfare back in the day. Iron Maiden.
Yeah, not your classic... rock band reference, but
no Eddie.
no Eddie on this one. This is a armored looking lady. So, but so this is their chance to dive deep into these sort of different characters. But and it points out kind of how geeky all the characters are, because they're making fun of Abe, who based on studying her tapes can predict how the fight's going to go type of thing. And you're like, yeah, I guess that does work out. And then we cut again to the Grandmaster, Elder of the Universe. And that's the Thunderbolts original plot line. And they have Nighthawk. Too much DC on the brain, but Kyle Richmond, who was part of the Thunderbolts and got kicked off. Well, left, kicked off, however you want to split it. And he's on their squad and they're tracking down this wellspring of power. And whoever can control that will control all this massive amount of power. And Speed Demon was sidelined by Joystick in a previous episode.
And if Zemo wins, then this universe dies.
Oh, that seems a
dies.
Little...
Dies!
And then we go back again to our Hank Pym classic yellow jacket and Radioactive Man. And Radioactive Man has given them a little grief. Because, you know, they're going against, they're trying to lock up Captain America. Captain America. Not Nomad, Steve. Captain America.
And look who was telling them. I mean, it's Radioactive Man. Again, he's the most level-headed one out here.
You know what you get an ad for in here? The Digital Revolution. Visit Marvel.com and get some free, like, Ultimate X-Men or Ultimate Spider-Man digital comics. Marvel.com's new digital comics are shaking up the way the world views comics, with page-by-page and smart panel viewing options. Boy, we're almost in today.
It's a digilution.
I'm a page-by-page man, personally. But Cap and Zemo go back and forth. Again, we reference the Bucky, the classic Bucky story, and Zemo's selling it. Like Steve says, our storytelling team makes even these talking head scenes flow well. And expositive, and another throwback, a classic other Thunderbolts trope is to mine the old territory to Geoff Johns this thing. And one of the things
what?
That happens...
Roy Thomas this thing?
I feel like Geoff Johns is more about milking it, like finding some small segment and really giving you 12 issues out of half a panel.
So we're not Mark Waiting it or Kurt Busicking it?
No. We're Thunderbolts.
Mark Gruenwelding it?
Well, you can say Kurt Busick. He's a Thunderbolts guy. But I feel like there's a a substantive difference in them. When Roy Thomas did it, it really was sort of like a bit of a nod to the book, but not, you know, wouldn't launch into some 12-issue run about what happened between A and B, you know?
Yeah, I guess it's not connecty obsessive enough. That's what I usually associate Roy Thomas, just more...
The king of continuity. But
yeah,
what
and
we,
Conan.
The point we've taken from this is Steve's Foot Locker, from you referenced the attack before, he's able to pluck it from the time stream or whatever weird pseudoscience we're using now, and it gives him back his memories. And that's what seals the deal. And Cap ends up taking the key to the secret prison.
See, this is all right and good, but then when Zemo transports back to his folding castle, it's that creepy room from his old base with the Bucky costume and his father's photos, his china set and all that, and then he does the whole thing with his face. Oh, I can, you know, I'm putting my face back to normal, and I'm just like, I don't know.
Wait, which face is normal? Yeah, now I'm wondering which face is the normal face. And I like the portrait of Dad with his hand on the big globe.
And you know, that's one of those globes that's probably a bar, too. It, like, opens up in the middle and
helps
it. But yeah, now we've raised. Originally, he was claiming that he was not burned and was just showing a burned face to make the heroes feel guilty. But now... like
every
you,
time
Steve,
he puts that,
like,
mask on, I wonder if he's letting himself return to burned under there or something.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Is he burned or is he unburned? And we don't know, because Melissa comes in and he fixes. And this is where he drops that he knows he's going to get betrayed. You will have betrayed me.
Three times.
So, yeah, Zemo's now getting quite Christ-like, which is scary. Because he ends it with, so you're going to die, Melissa asks. He says, not die, live forever. I'm like, okay, now I know Zemo's gone fully over the bend. But that leads us into the next one, which has a dynamic color of cover with our man, fake Superman.
Hyperion? No, not that Hyperion.
Another Hyperion.
On the cover, a menacing songbird with a giant chess piece over his head.
Yeah,
so,
Songbird gets a lot of covers, like Zemo.
She's got the best design.
Yeah.
And we're back to full covers, not the Civil War half covers, which is nice. And we get our recap reminding us that Joystick is a double agent for the Elder of the Universe. Grandmaster.
Oh, yeah.
Grandmaster Flash, as I like to call him, even though that's not really his name. Big blue guy. So now we get to, and it's pretty seamless. We go back to these Hyperion, Dr. Spectrum, and Nighthawk taking on the guardians of the different wellsprings. And they're these robotic monks. And it turns out they're able to find... They're shutting down each portal, and they got to find the last one, basically. And then at the last one, you know, they'll be all there. And that's going to be the race. So it's the Thunderbolts racing these characters to see who can get to the last one. And the person that comes out, surprisingly, to help is Speed Demon, with two broken legs and a wheelchair. And he's at Doctor Strange's house. And for those of you younger listeners, Doctor Strange is connected to Nighthawk because they were both in the Defenders. So that's why Wong is helping him. And what's weird is that, and I guess this makes sense, but it's an interesting way to take it, because Speed Demon has heightened reflexes and has to process so much information so quickly, he's actually good at deciphering these ancient scrolls and trying to figure out the patterns in them. Which I actually thought made sense. Like, I didn't mind giving him that ability. Did it trouble either of you boys?
No, it was cool.
Yeah, it's all right. I don't think that ability will ever show up again. Well, all right. At least not for another 10 years or something.
That's all right with Wong. That's all right with me.
You know, Zub made some notes when he did his reread. I'm sure that's going to come back in this new run.
I was thinking Superior Foes and everything. Like, that's not something they would really want to touch on.
No, Speed Demon maybe wasn't the sharpest, but what's interesting is Speed Demon turns out to be a double agent, and he meets with Mach 4, and his idea is that he's betraying him because he wants to get his powers back, first of all, which Grandmaster said he would do, but he's like, I'd rather have Zemo, who's a human, than this weird Elder of the Universe, Because if we have to, we can take on Zemo. And I'm like, yeah, you can't take on Zemo unpowered. I'd really like to see Mach 4 and Speed Demon take on Wellspring powered with two Moonstones Zemo. And I like how they always have the Moonstones floating around him. Unlike Carla, he didn't ever incorporate them into his person. I don't know why. You would think it would be the ultimate protection, even though they can control them when they're not by him. Why risk someone with a teleporting power who could teleport them to some other dimension or whatever?
He's seen it get ripped out of people a few times from the third person. I don't, that happened to you eventually.
Because I think that's what I'd send, is like a teleporter and have them just teleport the things to who knows where, you know. And then he'd have to go try and track them down. But we're building up, and he gives even more crazy speeches about the Wellspring and the facing off against these two. And I'm like, while I like Zemo, there is no way, like, an Elder of the Universe should be getting played at all by, like, a person. I don't care how many Moonstones you give them, but sometimes we have these. I've had these issues in the past. I think it's troubled you guys less, where I feel like some characters just don't have any shots against other characters.
You know what really shocked me? That the Guardians of the Galaxy showed up again in this issue. You remember those Guardians? I looked at this long history, and I'm like, I thought we were done with them from, like, Thunderbolts. I don't know. It was in the 40s, and we're like, oh, no, not those Guardians. Like, these Guardians. These guys could have been in the Guardians of Infinity.
A Kree, a Skrull, a Shi'ar, a Badoon, and a... I don't know what you call that thing.
A walking in a hood.
Caliban. Yeah.
But it's weird. It's like, oh, they almost came back, you know, with the Phoenix. Like, and it seems like they almost never show up. And I'm like, yeah, I guess the universe ending and all this crazy Earth stuff never causes them to really...
Well, they're on the other side of the universe dealing with some other universal destruction at the time.
And you know what is weird about this issue? It's like they go to great depths to explain away why people get superpowers. And I'm like, kind of unnecessary, but okay. If that's the basis for the story, you know.
So it's showdown time. They both teams know, but we get it from the perspective of the Thunderbolts. And so they send the main team to send in to check out this last Wellspring section. And like geniuses, they send the smuggler in. Because, you know, he's real useful. And consequently, he ends up getting trapped. And that freaks Atlas out. And forces the showdown with the Guardian. What did they call? I forgot what they called this Hyperion Dr. Spectrum. I apologize. Were they calling themselves the Squadron Supreme? I thought they had some new name. And it's a big battle royale.
Yeah, Radioactive Man takes on Superman.
Yeah. Because it's a rematch, in a sense, we remember. But now they have different counters to the different blows. But they still don't counter. He's able to still change his radioactive powers to absorb the one that helps power him. So it's no match. Radioactive Man wins again. And much like, again, Joystick knocks the crap out of Nighthawk. Again, I feel like I like Nighthawk. I feel he shouldn't be there, you know. Yep. Like, he should be a more prominent, he's not a punchline.
My fingers are crossed that he still has a role to play.
And just as Zemo is about to grab the power, a hand comes out, and in a very kind of Frank Robbins panel, when you turn the page, I thought, Grandmaster flies out and attacks him. And I really like that panel. I know some people don't like him, but I have fond memories of his art. Just very kind of exaggerated and dark shadows. Like, it's just the one panel, too. It was like a little tribute in my head. But yeah, so it's these two galactic titans. And you'll never
Zemo's
guess.
Zemo's a galactic titan. Crazy.
And you'll never guess who wins.
Oh, Zemo totally wrecks the Grandmaster Flash, right?
And right now... Right here, Grandmaster, right now you will die. And he just evaporates the dude. All that's left is his cloak.
His gloves.
And he's like, well, he destroyed him. And now Zemo's got all the power.
Oh, but we look out for Joystick, though.
Yeah, and at that point, Radioactive Man and Melissa are deliberating, do they betray him? But just when that happens, Joystick shows up and Zemo's like, yeah, really? I knew you were going to betray me, Joystick. I'm no idiot. I'm not Nighthawk. And she explains that she was promised all these, if she would get to be the intergalactic champion, if she served Grandmaster, you know, because she's just all about silly challenges and everything. And that's where we get another plot twist. And we find out about her staves that you mentioned. And the staves weren't designed to absorb the energy. They're designed to disperse it. So she throws them into the last wellspring, which blows everything up and sends the wellspring everywhere. And I'm like, whew, this is not a way to end an issue. I got to click that next button.
Well, it keeps on telling you, don't you want to read another one?
Yes, and I do. I do. I want to read 107, which has... which I don't understand the cover, because we saw the Grandmaster die, but he's on the cover of this one. How could that be? Once you die in comics, you never come back.
Especially if you're an elder of the universe.
Isn't that what Bucky does? But it's a great cover. Like, his face is mostly in shadow, except glowing eyes, and he's giant and blowing up the skyline with buildings and cars and thunderbolts flying. Although, I don't see Zemo on the cover. Interesting. Hmm. But he did blow up Joystick for some weird reason. So maybe... But, what, you know, I'm not going to hold it to him. But again, we've got the same creative team going into this climactic finish. But instead of leaving us where we left off, we flash to Chicago. And a shirtless, but wearing his armor, Whirlwind shows up. Kevin, how excited were you?
I'm here in my old armor.
I had forgotten, like, the no-shirt-wearing armor.
Yeah, it's quite bad.
Well,
quite
fetching. You know, I went to the facility where they have the armor, and I'm like, oh no, it's not in the locker, it's only my old one, not my new one. Oh well.
So, but it looks like you've been hitting the gym, because you're pretty muscular, I gotta say.
Well, what else am I gonna do in jail?
So basically, when the wellspring hit, it gave everyone powers, and they drives them all crazy. So all the different Thunderbolt squads, the Alpha, Beta, all the ones we don't consider real ones, are sent out to try and quell all these riots. So this is a squad led by Dr. Octopus, who, despite leading at least 97 variations of various supervillain teams, seems incapable of and I'm like, didn't he lead like Kraven and all them other, like? Yep. I don't mean
he's
to
not
be
a Thunderbolt.
No, but I was kind of wondering, maybe because the problems are too overwhelming, because of like there's hundreds of superpowered beings and things going on and all that.
And Red
but
Ronin.
Yeah, I expect like people are looking for him for orders and everything, and I'm like, they should be. He's Doc Ock. He's led a lot of stuff.
Yeah, he is overwhelmed in this, which I took the characterization okay, but I wasn't super thrilled. I mean, I feel like he should be more in it. But what the most important person is actually Overmind, and he's the one that's being the Professor X and keeping all the groups in contact, because Beta Squad is in Los Angeles. They look like a bunch of, that's the Texas Twister and all the real like low rent.
Well, you know how
LA. L.A. gets no love. Come on. Dallas.
Half of those characters are like from the New Warriors book.
Dallas has the Beetle Squad. They've got the UFOs. It's got Red Ronin, like Steve. Like, how does Dallas get a way better squad than L.A.? That's what I'm saying.
Is that also Sydney, Australia?
Yeah. Dan Leaf Insect Man has gone crazy with power. And he has to be attacked by Omega Squad, also looks like. I can't tell if that's like Killer Strike up there, maybe. Like, I don't recognize a lot of these dudes, I'll be honest. I do like that they send Batroc the Leaper and to Tokyo. So a lot of guys are getting kicked in the face.
That's kind of hilarious.
But basically, they're being overwhelmed. But Overmind is rendered in a very Kirby-esque appearance, which I like. But what Thunderbolt was left behind? The swords. And he takes on Joystick, who shatters his adamantium sword.
Well, but so, that's never happened before.
Yeah.
How is that possible?
It's only a covering, remember, because they talked about that when he was fighting Wolverine. But yeah, somehow she smashes it, even though Wolverine's claws couldn't smash it right away. But it was a weird drop because when some of the transitions in these books do seem not right. Because the last one ends with the castle exploding. And that one just jumps, like, presumably it exploded right where she was. But yet she's free and Swordsman's free and the other people under the... Like, it seems not sensical, the spacing of it.
Did you see her explanation of why she was able to shatter his sword, too? That it's the power of the wellspring that her staff is energized by, but that it's also that power of the wellspring that allows vibranium and adamantium to be bonded to each other.
Yeah, like I really didn't need an explanation for all this stuff.
Yep, leave Cap out of it.
Yeah.
Well, not just that, but they also explained before that it wasn't really about channeling those, it was about dispersing them. So I guess she's the unreliable narrator who just says stuff. But as he pleads.
That's why I guess I wasn't down with this whole wellspring thing, too. But, you know, rereading it, I'm like, eh, it's actually not as bad as I thought it was.
It's bad, but not that bad.
So, Swordsman rebuilds his sword. Which, you know, I guess he just keeps extra sheaths in the thing. Or what?
Yeah, just extra blades. He just clicks a new handle onto it.
And uses his mutant force, because now, obviously, the local citizens there have been overwhelmed with it. That leaves Joystick to go back, and all the Thunderbolts are trapped. And, like, sort of like Graviton style. You know how he would have them hanging and floating? But they have these, like, gold ribbons around, which I assume is the wellspring power. And they're shocked at her betrayal. I'm not shocked, but they are. And that's
now I know what her purpose is.
And that's when Overmind, and a really nice page, connects with Songbird to tell her, like, it's going bad. So she's in that kind of ghosty astral form in the background. And in the foreground is, like, Doc Ock and Iron Man and Cap fighting all the civilians. Like, just a great, great page. I mean, I'm not super thrilled with this version of Iron Man's armor. We're still in, like, the bulky phase a little bit. I mean, not full Hulkbuster, but the kind of bulkier style of armor, which was never really... I mean, I like it as a specialty armor, but as his day-to-day armor, I don't like the really bulky one designs. And Doc Ock's about ready to flee. He's going to break the line and run away. And so, basically, over a few pages, it builds up, and it's got to be... Melissa's got to decide, like, it turns out what they need to do is to bring Zemo back, and a power we have seen, Melissa can use these, like... subharmonic pitches to manipulate people. You just go with it. We've seen it a little bit before. I don't know how it works, but Overmind's going to boost her up, but to boost her so they can retrieve Zemo so he can fight the Grandmaster and fix this, he's going to have to stop doing some of the stuff he's doing, which means more innocent people suffer and the battle will go bad, but it's their only hope. It's Zemo. And you know things are bad when Zemo's your only hope. So he withdraws, and we get some awesome Texas Twister. I didn't know how much you love that character, Steve.
Reckon I do.
You know who I like in here, though? The Smiling Tiger and Bloodstrike.
Yeah, isn't he an Image character, I want to say? B-L-U-D-S-T-R-R-R-Y-Y-K. You know, Jim Sanders is in the... both legs broken by a joystick, so he's not actually fighting, but he suddenly gets zapped by the wellspring power, and that's when there's this realization that, you know, it's the end of the line, basically. They're all going to do, and again, a new power by the Swordsman. He's absorbing all the superhuman powers, and I don't know how he's doing that. I mean, he projects force blades. Again, it's not the worst thing, but it's one of those weird, like, what? Wait, where is this coming from? How is that working?
That's a mighty impressive sword.
Well, remember, and it's not even his original. That's the new bladed one.
Yeah, I guess he has a lot of specialty blades, but you kind of wonder, I'm like, oh, maybe he should have used this one previously. I don't know. I guess he liked the other one a lot. Like, it was an adamantium sheath, and he's like, oh, this is awesome.
But the key, I think, with this is to kind of just go with stuff. There's going to be a few little bumps, but speaking of bumps, Joystick's staff is too hot. She realizes, she hears Melissa kind of mumbling and Zemo mumbling, and she's like, wait, that can't be a coincidence. And then she goes to attack Melissa. But when she attacks Melissa, suddenly the swordsman shows up, and he's all tingling with power, and they go to fight. But when they go to fight, that allows Melissa to contact Zemo, and then we go into Zemo's private garden.
Yeah, where everyone's naked, apparently.
And that's when he understands that she represents his heart, but Carla shows up representing his head. So it's his, like, subconscious kind of battling out. And that's when she mentions she'll never know the real you and shows the scarred, which makes me think he really is scarred, but maybe it's just his subconscious scarring. Again, I'm confused. And this is when Ock finally gives up, and he's like, Thunderbolts be damned, I'm leaving. And that's when... nice Doc Ock moment. So that scene's getting intercut with Zemo's fantasy land, which is intercut with swordsmen and joystick fighting. But Melissa's like, look, you got to retrieve him and destroy him. The whole world's depending on you. She appeals to his ego, which is always the way to go with Zemo.
Yep.
Even if he's going to do something good, it's all through his ego. So Zemo comes back, and there's a big explosion. And suddenly, out of the Kirby crackle, you see the Grandmaster appear, and he says, Zemo. Uh-oh. Zemo says, Grandmaster.
Is it, or is it Huma Sapien?
Oh, wow.
To be continued, and that's where we leave off this exciting segment of Thunderbolts.
Wow, that's
we'll Andrew, can I correct you? To be included.
Yeah, so, it's quite a cliffhanger.
So we end with a big cliffhanger. And for those of you unfamiliar with our past segments, Kevin, contemporaneously when these issues came out, kept different records. So we're peered to a treat to a old Kevin from 10 years ago. So, Kevin, do we have any record of 10 years ago, Kevin, what he thought of this, the Civil War and all this stuff?
I got sad news for you guys. I looked at my old calendars.
And 2006, Kevin is dead.
I ate him. The calendar is going by normally. He's rating all his issues. I see Thunderbolts 104. He gives it a 7.7, which I think is up from last time, or still pretty good. It, you know, he's enjoying this stuff, apparently. Apparently, I remembered the Wellspring stuff a lot more than I should have. Who would have thought?
Okay, so then what happens?
So then I look at the next month, and it's almost all blank. And then I look and then I turn the page again for the next month, and he stopped keeping records at this point.
Whoa, 2006, Kevin.
Yeah,
he found Marvel Noise podcast.
But I don't know when he started doing the ratings on iFanboy, because I know on their website they introduced a rating system at some point where you could just rate stuff. Like, they would show the weekly releases, and then after you read the stuff, you could just rate it and see what other people rated it. So I don't think that happened in 2006 exactly, but, you know, he would get into rating again, but, you know, that's a different type of record keeping.
He would live to rate again.
Yes, he would.
Well, your assignment in the interim while we read these issues is to find out when the next Kevin from the past lurks. Is that, well, do you have any recollections of how you felt back then? How about that? If we don't have a record.
7 point something.
Yeah, like he gave it 7.7. Like, I remember the over-explanation and all that stuff, and I thought that went down in issue 100 and everything along with that other stuff. But yeah, I guess the Grandmaster stuff went, and while that one element annoyed me, like Zemo building the team with all these different supervillains, I guess that was all right with me, and I thought that was cool.
How about 2016, Kevin? How does he feel?
Yeah, it's not bad. I've read worse Thunderbolt stories than this one.
I think this feels like the march towards 75, where everything's just hitting the fan and too much stuff is going on, and where's Moonstone?
I feel like Moonstone could come back.
Yeah, well,
but as you guys said, the art team is just solid on this.
Oh, yeah. I think that's probably why I enjoyed some of the issues more, too, is because I think the art here is way more solid than the art going up to 75.
Fair enough.
So, yeah, we have two more issues to go. We have the conclusion, and then we have the one-off before Thunderbolts marches on into the modern era.
Wow, we've come a long way. But yeah, I also, to add my two cents, enjoyed these issues. I think it was a lot, like Steve mentioned, just great storytelling, composition. These issues really flow when you have a squad like that handling it. They're a treat to read. So even these kind of little nitpicks that edge at you don't derail you, because it's just such a pleasure. The story just flows.
And I'm kind of matching up Zemo stuff, like the things he says here about like his motivations and things about being a hero and being a villain and redemption, because I'm seeing where he, like, I know where he goes after this, so I'm kind of like trying to figure out if those later stories fit in with these stories.
Well, that's yeah, I hope I enjoyed these. I hope the listener tunes in for our next segment and we continue what will happen with Baron Zemo. Maybe all of the Marvel U will be extinguished by the wellspring of power.
Yeah.
But I've enjoyed this, and like I said, hope you continue. And thanks for me and the boys.
Later.